Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about development and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. My name is John, and I am a web developer, and I am joined by JP. How are you doing today, JP?
I'm doing well. Nothing much more to say there. I'm doing
just a Wednesday morning.
Yeah, just a nice Wednesday morning.
Awesome. Well, this week we are going through a bunch of great refactors. We are still in the book Refactoring by Martin Fowler, and we've been doing this ping pong thing where we talk more high level and then dig into some nitty gritty refactors. And this is one of those getting our hands dirty and digging into some great refactors episode. And so let's just kick things off. What's your first refactor that we're going to talk through, JP?
Cool. Yeah. So I think it might be worth mentioning the refactors that we had done before. So I have a list of them so we can briefly blow through those. So if you have the book, I'll even give you page numbers. So the refactors we touched on two episodes ago are extract function, which is on page 106, change function declaration, which is on page 124, replace temp with query, and I don't have a page for that, so I lied. And then also replace conditional with polymorphism. So those are four heavy hitters, really good refactors. I'd encourage you to jump back two episodes if you want to hear us discuss that in more detail. But without further ado, the first sort of refactor I have is called introduce parameter object, which is on page 140. And you know, I feel like we've definitely have talked about this in some form from other books, maybe even Pooter. I think Pooter has this idea objects. So what parameter objects are basically, if you have a function and you have maybe three or four arguments, the idea behind this refactor is to basically, instead of sending three or four separate arguments, you send in a single object or a single hash or a single whatever the data structure is in your language of choice. And the reason that you would do something like this is because grouping a data structure as such is valuable because it makes a more explicit relationship between the items that you're passing to the function. And it makes your code a lot more flexible and nice. So it's like you don't have to worry about the order of the arguments that are being sent into your function. So an example of this is, I just stole this code from the book, but there's a sample function called amountInvoiced, and you're passing in a start date and an end date as two separate arguments. But what you can do to refactor this is instead send an object called like dateRange, and dateRange would hold the object start date and end date. So in this case, it's not necessarily a benefit of like order because it's just two arguments, right? Like, you know, most people are competent enough to be able to know what like two arguments is like not a big deal. But in this case, I think it's more so that grouping your data structure is you're being very explicit that there's a relationship between these two items, and it makes it more, you know, it makes it more flexible and more expandable in the future. And I think the intent is very clearly shown.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think too, the other benefit you get from introducing these parameter objects is it's much easier to set default values, which I think is way understated on how valuable that is. And so, for example, if you have like a service object in Ruby and you have parameter, like you're parameterizing your arguments for that method to call that, you can call it without any parameters in it. And that's really useful to be able to do that, to kind of have set default values for what that calls. Super useful in JavaScript or whatever you're using as well, because you can really define what the base argument should be. Start date, end date is a perfect example because I find myself doing that one oftentimes within parameters. It's like, oh, I need these values, but within a certain range. And then it's nice to be able to say the default is returning the last 24 hours or the last 1 month, depending on your context. And then you're only passing in different values if you need to. So yeah, it's really powerful refactor, introducing parameter object. Awesome. The next one I've got is replace constructor with factory function. It's on page 334 in the book. And conceptually, the bottom line here is instead of creating new objects or things right in line or right in the context of your code, you encapsulate the creation of objects, the initialize of the creation, into some kind of a factory function. And, you know, in JavaScript, I'll give a quick example that I've had recently. I was doing an e-commerce site, and on every single page, we're having to pass the available variants from the back end to the front end. So you want to buy a shirt, and the shirt comes in many colors and many sizes, and each one of those colors and sizes has its own inventory levels, has a lot of different data that we needed to kind of hydrate from our back end to our front end in this context. And initially, what we were doing is we were setting this really big JSON array very manually at the top of the file. And so it was really kind of this ugly way of pulling in and setting this big JSON against every product. It was very manual and tedious to do it this way. And so what we ended up coming up with was a variant factory function. And basically, all we had to do is pass just the product IDs into this variant factory. And the variant factory was responsible to return all the different distinct individual values, pull in default values where we needed to, and did a lot of that logic that we were doing on this heavy lifting in this very ugly inline method. And then we could reuse this variant factory component across a lot of different pages and functionality. In Ruby, we do this constantly as well, you know, with, for example, let's say you have a new user and a user belongs to an organization. It's nice to be able to encapsulate that into something like a user organization factory so that you can create a new user and the user's organization at the same time versus having to call this with different methods in line and different functions in line. It gets really ugly. And it's kind of related to form objects in a way in Ruby that you're encapsulating the delegation of many different things potentially or the customization of many different things within them. So there's two kind of quick examples in Ruby and JavaScript with how powerful constructor and factories can be. It's really cool.
Cool. Wait, what was the official title of this one again?
Yeah, I kind of botched that. The official title is Replace Constructor with Factory Function.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, so constructor would be doing it inline and kind of sloppy, where factory encapsulates that construction of new things inline. And I think it's undersold too, because it's not just object-oriented. Like this can be if you're constantly building, like I said, different JSON objects. There's really clean ways to do that and encapsulates that logic.
Okay, so this is not to be confused with like the initialize method in Ruby or the constructor method in JavaScript. It doesn't literally mean like replace the constructor function with a factory. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I think that I would say in Ruby, you could replace the initialize method with a factory function though. Like you can have a call a factory object.new that delegate to the subsequent, like to the subsequent form, like to the subsequent models beneath it if you need to. And I think some of these refactors, like the names can be misleading. And I think it's important to be very pragmatic about your approach of like, what does this mean and how can I use it conceptually versus exactly how that plays out and what these words mean? Because words mean things.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So that's a good one. So my next refactor is called Combine Functions into Class, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's on page 144. And basically what it is if you have a bunch of functions that are related to each other, instead of just having them all over the place or, you know, littered into whatever class you're using them in, is to group them by its own class. And so the example that I made, which may or may not be pretty contrived, is imagine if you had a bunch of like math related functions like add, subtract, max, min, which, you know, probably already exist in the framework or in the language of your choice. But instead of just having like a function that you write called like max or min, you know, make a new class called math and then have methods in that class called max and min. And then so like you have this nice thing, which already exists in JavaScript and I'm pretty sure in Ruby. Or no, it's a little different in Ruby. Anyways, you have it in JavaScript where you can call like math.max and you could pass in arguments, right? So that is really nice because you can see what class it's coming from, like what static methods this class is coming from, as opposed to just calling like max on something. And so this is like a lot more helpful if you have one example in a real life production code base is we have a lot of like time slot and time zone utilities in open listings. I mean, we have to, right? So we're spread across the United States and you can book a tour in Texas and you can book a tour in California. Now a showing agent's schedule is obviously like dependent on the time zone. And so we have a bunch of static functions that you could call against a time zone class, which makes it really nice to be able to say, like, I don't know, time zone dot next available or something like that, which is a lot more explicit and easier to understand where this function is like coming from versus just next available.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a perfect example, like class and time zone stuff. The other one that I see a lot that works really well is API calls, like into its own class, which is really nice, especially if you have a smaller app that doesn't do a lot, that only has a few API calls, let's say. It's nice to have that delegate to a parent class, because then you can have things like a default error 500 that throws, and you can share that between instead of having to think of that edge case and catch that failure across different API calls, or let's say like heading the security tokens in the header, like all those like header settings and some of those other related APIs. That's a really good thing to put into a parent class. I'm trying to think of some other things off the top of my head where I've kind of extracted a bunch of related functions into its own class.
Okay.
Those are two really good examples, I think.
I have a question for you then, because we also do this thing where we just create helper methods or helper classes that are actually modules and not classes. So instead of like calling like a math.max, we'll do like an include math helpers, and then you just have access to all of those functions as if they were like in that class. I don't know, like, do you find yourself making helper methods more than actually making classes that group functions 100%. Together?
100%. And broadly extract function into class, I would group that into that refactor. So when I'm saying like grouping API calls, oftentimes for me, that isn't API dot, at least in JavaScript, that's not what I would reach for. Partly because my JavaScript isn't that great to be able to understand like, okay, this is a class, this is encapsulated in this way. But oftentimes what I would do is, okay, let's split all these functions into their own file, include them, and then use it as if it was a class. So I use that term loosely, extract function into class. I think specifically what it's saying is create a class object that has functions against it. But I think what you're saying as well is, which is just kind of including other functions into this file, has the same benefit in practice as far as cleaning up your code, having a place for it, and having it accessible in one place, fallback functions, all these other things that you can do. Yeah, like off the top of my head, I know that there's a ton of benefits to actually using a formal parent class, but I wouldn't know the difference between those. And to me, it kind of encapsulates the same idea, which is extracting these things into their own thing that you can use across in other places.
Yeah, I kind of like the idea of like having static methods in a class versus like helper functions, which I feel like I should do the former more frequently, because one of my pet peeves is when you're in like a huge Ruby class, right? And you have at the top, there's like six different things that are included. And like, who knows whether or not all six of those, if mm-hmm. methods are being called from like each one of those six included helper files. And it just gets so sure. hard because like you see all these like methods being called from God knows where. And it's like you don't know where they're coming from. And I feel like this also solves that problem, because if you had to call like API dot generate headers, like you know exactly where generate headers is coming from.
Yeah. I think that's true. And in Ruby, I think that's generally how I would write it. And because that's natural to me, it's very object oriented and that's kind of a first class citizen. But I was thinking of JavaScript when you asked the question on like how to include those things. And so I guess my short answer is in JavaScript, it's the Wild West and I just kind of throw in functions. Where in Ruby, I'm better about thinking about what object this is, whether it's a service object, or whether it's own model, and interacting with that model or service object with like calling dot methods on it or functions on it, which is more accurately methods in Ruby, but whatever. but I think as far as when I'm using JavaScript, I tend to just kind of split up files and then include functions. It's not as clean. Like I don't really create JavaScript objects ever when I work with JavaScript. It's just not where my brain goes when I'm in JavaScript.
Yeah, totally.
The next one I had is funny because it's really related to what you were just talking about, which is extract function into class. That one we were just talking about is on page 182. This one is split phase. I love the name of it. Sounds like a good hardcore band. Split phase. It's kind of a variant of extract function. Basically, the idea here is when a function is dealing with many different things, look for a way to split them out into discrete approaches. So it's a cleaner approach. So a perfect example is kind of what we were just talking about. The idea of kind of interaction code and logic and then API code all in one function, it's nice to be able to split that API call into its own functions or even if its own other file and kind of delegate it to another place. And so the idea within split phase is thinking about kind of what a function is doing. So if you're using like vanilla JS, it's getting DOM elements, it's permutating DOM elements, listening for responses, like these other things that are very much more front end. Then maybe it's doing an API call and cleaning that data and doing there. I think it's tempting when you're first writing JavaScript or whatever framework you're working in to just kind of put everything in line. Like I remember in the old days when I was first writing Ruby, I would have a Ruby method that cleans a user input, validates the user's input, calls an API, sends the API call, handles the response all in one method within a model. And it was just like, that one method is doing like 8 different things. Like at a high level, it's not doing the same thing. So split phase is really talking about extracting functions, but extracting those functions in groupings of kind of what they're doing, what they're handling. And I think especially in JavaScript, it's easy to just kind of write a function and make it all work and then leave it alone. But there's a lot of value in stopping and thinking, okay, maybe consolidate the things that are getting the items, consolidate my event listeners, consolidate my API delegation, consolidate cleaning the user input or my validation, and trying to get these kind of into higher order groupings to themselves and then delegate them into their own functions accordingly.
Yeah, that's cool. And it sounds like split phase, if you're looking at a huge chunk of code, let's say it's like 20 or so lines, it sounds to me like in most real life scenarios, if you were to execute split phase, it would come very naturally, right? Like there's probably like, it's like, okay, these 3 lines of code have to do with like making an API call. You know, these next 3 lines have to do with like sanitizing the data and forming it like how I need the data to be formatted. And then these 3 lines are, you know, doing some other thing where it's like making some change to the UI. It seems like it would be like a very natural thing. And in fact, it might be one of those things where, you know, when you're like sort of like sandboxing or prototyping things out, you just like throw things at the computer screen and like you're like, okay, so this works. I finally got like something on the screen and working. I feel like the next step would be like split phase, right? So it's like, okay, we got the things working. Now let's start refactoring this to be presentable for like actual code review or something.
Absolutely. So the next thing I kind of wanted to do is talk through a recent JavaScript story that I had. And as you know, I'm kind of more junior on JavaScript and still really trying to up my skills and move more into that area. I've been more of a Rails guy and Rubyist in the past. But I wanted to talk through a specific piece of code that I was able to write this week and really throw the book. I threw the book at this code and it made the JavaScript so much better. And at the end of the day, what I delivered like way, way better. So I want to kind of talk through this start to finish. All right.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, cool. So what we had is we had a standard Rails application that was an e-commerce site. So that's what my client came to me with. Everything was just static ERB templates. And so when you would add something to your cart, it would send you to a whole new page and it would be, you know, the domain /cart. And then every action you took on the cart would take a page reload. So, you know, adjusting an item's quantity in the cart, you would set the value and click adjust item. Removing an item from your cart, you'd click delete, it would reload the page. Everything was very much Rails server rendered. And so the request was, what we want is we don't want the cart to ever take a page reload. And we want the whole thing to be in this nice popover component that slides in from the side. And we don't want any page reload. So when you add an item to cart, it slides open. There's an animation that adds it to the cart. And anything that you do in the cart, from adjusting a quantity to removing a line, nothing should take a page reload. It should all be super clean and super modern feeling and very responsive. So the idea is there that you have this slide over cart that's really interactive and engaging with the rest of the e-commerce experience. And it's not this like really clunky moving to different pages. And so I approached this using Vue. So we put Vue on top of Rails and it was a really great experience. So that's my pick for this week. So that's the spoiler, is Vue on Rails has been an amazing experience. You get data binding out of the box. You get a lot of great stuff. And just in general, having a more modern JavaScript stack is nice because you're on Webpack and it's just a whole different experience versus like statically compiled JavaScript and reload. It feels archaic now to reload a page to see if my JavaScript's doing what I'm expecting. Long story short is I spun up some API endpoints for the cart and for the object and order manipulation. So I was like, okay, the first step is I'm going to need to be able to access this data through an API endpoint to be able to use Vue to manipulate the data, because I can't just throw it, you know, at my controllers and expect it to respond. So that was easy. That was just in Ruby, getting those API endpoints. Once I had that, then I started, got the markup in place, and then started thinking through these. And, you know, this is at the stage where I'm just hacking this thing together. So when I really first started working and this thing was working, I had 5 methods in JavaScript in the context of Vue, but just for practical purposes in JavaScript. I had add item, remove item, increase item count, decrease item count, and set line item count. And so each one of those things did different things in the cart. So I could add an item to the cart, I could remove it from the cart, increase item count. There's like a little plus and minus sign that lets you just like increase the count of the item, and then remove item would just be like an X that removes it. So the first thing I did is everything was working, and it like took a relatively short amount of time to get everything wired up and working, which is a testament to Vue and Rails and everything there, which was nice. So everything was looking good, but I had this really big 160 line JavaScript file that wasn't well written, and it was a lot of places where it could be more dry. I'm doing API calls over and over. So the first thing I did is I actually thought about all my method names and thought, are these good names? And so I went through and I renamed some of my methods. So, you know, I was calling add item, and that's not very explicit on what it's doing. So then I changed that to add item to cart. Remove item became remove item from cart. Increase item became increase line item count. Decrease item became decrease line item count. So I tried to be more explicit about what my names were doing. The next thing I did is I extracted functions. I realized that both increase line item count and decrease line item count were doing something very similar. They were hitting an API endpoint that was adjusting the line item. So I created a new function called set line item quantity and had both of those methods delegate to that, both of those functions delegate to this new function. So basically, decrease line item count, increase line item count, we're just doing the same thing. So then the next refactor was using parameterized function that we've talked about in 3.10, which was basically instead of calling decrease line item count and increase line item count, I just got rid of those functions and I just call set line item quantity right from my Vue front end using my Vue listeners. I just literally use, so now the plus sign is set line item quantity with the plus and set line item quantity with the minus. And then I realized, well, actually, remove line item, all it's doing is setting the line item count to 0. So I was also able to remove that function. Then I was able to use inline function to simply alias another function. So that was what remove item was, is I just actually called the other of set line item count. The long story short here, and I don't want to get too detailed on all the code, but using these different approaches, I was able to take this from six different functions that was like over 160 lines of code down to a single function, one function, which is just set line item count. That's the only function that I needed to do all of this front-end interaction down to less than 60 lines. Way more dry. All my API calls were consolidated. So every single button and thing on this front-end of this nice popover component was only calling a single function that delegates to other functions, and it was very clean. All it was set line item count. I want to talk through like just a little bit of pros and cons and then kind of get your thoughts. Are you kind of tracking so far? Do you have any questions so far?
No, that was great. I feel like for talking about code, I like totally was able to follow that pretty well.
Okay, cool. I love this example because everybody knows e-commerce and what a cart is. So that's why this was an exciting opportunity. And like the refactor was so huge. It was so cool to realize like slowly chipping away and pulling the code back to realize that these six functions were all doing the exact same fucking thing under the hood. All they were doing was setting a line item count. Because I wrote the API in a way that if you set a line item count of 1 and the order didn't exist, it would create the order.
Right.
So my API was clean enough to just be able to understand that, or understand that if it's 0, the line item should just be removed. And so this is kind of too, I wanted to talk a little bit with you, the balance between front end and back end, mm-hmm. and finding the right fit between what logic should live in the JavaScript and what logic should live on your API endpoints. And I was wondering like if you had any thought of that, like, do you think my back end's doing too much here to automatically remove it when it's set to 0? Where do you find the balance between modifying your back end versus writing the logic in your front end?
Yeah. So the question is like, where does quote unquote business logic live? And it's
that's the question.
Yeah. It's interesting because you have like some magic going on under the hood, right? So like if you set line item count to 0, your backend should know that it's like going to delete that line item. Or if you set it to 1 when it previously wasn't 1, that you have to create a new thing.
Exactly.
That's super interesting because like, right, your backend should be the one that handles all of that. But then, mm-hmm. but then there is, there's also this knowledge gap almost of like, let's say you had two different teams, one that only works on front end and one that only works on back end things. You have to rely on your front end people knowing that those specific use cases like will do those things, right? Because it's different from a line item going from 2 to 3 or from 3 to 4 or from 5 to 4 to 3, mm-hmm. right? Like those all for all intents and purposes will do the same thing. But when you go from like 1 to 0, then like, you know, then some magic is going on under the hood. And I don't know where, like, I don't think that having that logic on the front end solves that problem, because now you have like, now you have potentially like increment and decrement logic that exists in two different places, which to mm-hmm. me sounds worse than implicit knowledge of like what's going on under the hood. So I think to like answer your question, I think all of that should be on the back end, but there has to be, I don't know, that's like where tests come into play, right? Because then you could like read your tests and be like, you know, describe line item count at 0, and then the expectation mm-hmm. should be like it removes the line item, or like it deletes that record, or like, you know, you would see all these edge cases, I think, in the back end, and that's like totally where it should live. Yeah, that's like definitely an interesting one too, because like at the same time, you're gonna have front end logic no matter what, right? Like obviously you want to have some sort of like front end validation and some front end testing that says like you can't have a set line item go to like -1 or like, you know, mm-hmm. right?
Of course.
So like in some ways, or like an upper bound, like you don't want to be able to add 40, or like let's say there's like there's only 6 available. You don't want a user to be able to like add 7.
Perfect example. Yep. And that's another example of what my backend is doing.
Yep.
If you try to add 7 to cart, it just won't update the value
mm-hmm.
because that's not available in inventory. So the backend is handling checking that you can't add to cart more than available inventory. But again, like very unclearly documented. Like it doesn't necessarily, beyond tests, it doesn't document that in any way in the code. And so it would be nice to have a front end, you know, function line that says something like ensure inventory value not over, but it doesn't really make sense to do that because all of that logic is in my Ruby backend. So it's like, I really struggled where that best fits. And I do feel like my endpoint is doing too much because it's destructively deleting, let's say, a line item in a cart when you set it to 0. And it's like, that doesn't, just because it's 0 doesn't necessarily mean it should be destroyed. Nil and 0 are two different things. And so I do feel like that a developer who's new in this code base could be a little confused interacting with the API. But it sounds like you're saying, in general, a good place to document that kind of domain-specific knowledge could be in your tests. And that could be one solution.
Yeah, I think I still stand by that most of that should be in the back end.
Mm-hmm.
But it does get tricky if, like, let's say you have, like, a contractor who's only, like, you know, has front-end experience and does, and like, sees back-end code and is like, I don't want to look at that. You know, then potentially you might run into some issues, but it's like, right, like, complex apps will be complex, or, like, large apps mm-hmm. will be large.
Yeah.
And it's just something that, like, you know, any engineer should be thinking about, like, the edge cases.
So the other question yeah. I wanted to ask you is, you know, so I took these 5 or 6 functions and pulled them all into one function, which is just adjust line item count, or set line item count is the name of the only function that I'm using now. But I almost feel like I took it too far, because add item to cart is so much more clear, and like a front end developer would understand what's happening. And it's weird that an add to cart button is calling a set line item count method or function. And so that is a little bit unclear. And so I feel like I should honestly pull back a little bit to maybe keep the set line item count function, even though all it's doing is delegating the call of, I should probably keep add to cart, even though all it's doing is delegating to set line item count. Would you agree with that? That sometimes it's good to have function names that just delegate to other functions just for clarity of use?
Yeah. So in my head, I think a good refactor from your current like state, the current mm-hmm. point at which you are, would be to like maybe bring back all those function names, like add item to cart,
really? Okay.
Delete mm-hmm. or remove item from cart, and all those are doing are calling set line item count. And I feel like that
right, and under the hood.
Yeah, and I feel like that would be like pretty good documentation in and of itself. So it's like, if you're seeing a method or if you're seeing a function that is only calling set line item count to zero, then presumably you would know that remove item from cart is that use case of, you know, when the line item count goes from like one to zero or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I think you're totally right, especially like thinking of the way Vue is using this with the implicit listeners, like, because in the DOM, you just put on V on click. And it would be so nice to have that method be called add item to cart. Like, it's so clear what it's doing. And then when you go and look at the add item to cart function, you realize, oh, all item to cart does is set that line item. And honestly, from there, that's self-documenting what the API is doing. And I almost feel like I want to go back and put back all five function names and just have them all delegate to a single function, because I'm getting all the pros of consolidating this all to a single function, and also all the pros of having the explicit names of all the different functions. It's just hard to know where that is. And it also feels really good to be calling only one function. Like, there's something about that that feels really good. But I would agree that it's lost some clarity in its intent. And in some ways, the original 160 lines versus the 60 was more clear in what it was doing in some ways. And so, yeah, so it sounds like you kind of agree that we should probably put back some of these function names, add another 10 lines in my JavaScript file, and just make it more clear what it's doing.
Yeah, potentially. I'd have to look at the code to be able to say for sure, but it sounds like a lot of like the logic is in the back end anyways. It's not like your front end is like doing a lot of crazy logic, potentially.
Mm-mm. It's all just hitting one endpoint, which is really nice.
So at the same time, it is kind of nice that you have like just the function that can like do all this stuff and then trust your backend to handle it appropriately. I don't know. I wanted to add that caveat so that I'm not too strongly one way or the other.
Yeah. I think the answer is always it depends. Yeah. That's just the answer in software. But I this was a really good learning experience for me in Vue, JavaScript, and in these refactorings in general, because I don't think if I approached it in this methodical step-by-step approach, like first rename them, then just extract one function, it was really that step of extracting the function of set line item count that made me like totally see all the code in a totally different way. Mm-hmm. Like in a perfect world, I would have seen from day one based on the mockups from the client that, oh, all this is doing the same thing. Like under the hood, all this is doing is setting line item counts to each item. But it's hard to see that when you first approach code. So I think it's important to not try to pre-optimize, because if I would have tried to gather that deep insight from the first moment of starting to write this code, I wouldn't have gotten it out the door as quickly as I was able to. And so I think it's good to just throw code at it, get it working, write your tests, and then just slowly refactor from there and gain those insights as you move along. Yep. And I think, honestly, in a lot of ways, not modifying your interface to your code is kind of a good approach. Because what I did is I gravely modified my interface, meaning the actual functions that my interface were calling were totally different than my original intent, when in reality, my original interface was so much more clear. And I refactored to the point of having to modify my interface, when in reality, that's maybe where you want to stop on your refactor. Like, really think hard before changing your interface too explicitly, because then you might be losing some clarity in your refactor. I think that's the one takeaway that I took, because I took this too far. Like, it's like, well, now it's like all this one weird, not very well-named thing, and it's all interacting with that one thing.
Yeah, I wonder if the solution is to just name that function to something better, and then you could like just keep it one function. I don't know. I think that the real answer is like, just make it so that whatever's going to be easier for future you or for future developers is really the answer. I think as developers, we spend a lot of time like bike shedding over like what a function should be named, but like maybe for a good reason, or maybe it's not bike shedding, but at the end of the day, it's like, is this going to be easier for me? Maybe it's a little dry. Maybe it's not so dry. Maybe it is. But like, I think as long as you can clearly understand what it is later, I think that's all that really matters. Like, add item to cart versus add item, that itself is like already a huge improvement. Because like, what the hell is add item? Is that like, you know, is that like actually adding an item, or is it like, who knows? Who really knows?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially like increase item. It's like, what is happening with increase item?
Yeah, totally.
Cool. I appreciate your thoughts on that refactor and kind of letting me share my excitement around that story. Do you have any picks for today?
I do. Okay, so my pick is like a Reddit thread, and it's like the thread is on CS career questions, which is like sometimes a toxic community, sometimes a helpful community. And it's literally just like a bunch of college students and like non-college students asking like, how do I get a job at Facebook, basically, like the big N companies is what they call them, like Facebook, yeah. Amazon, Airbnb, all the unicorns and whatnot. But this thread is called How Do You Keep From Burning Out at Your Job? Which I thought was really interesting because I used to be a big proponent of this idea that burnout doesn't exist. And I think that was like more so early on in my career when I was like very gung-ho about everything. And it was like, I'm going to go to work and then I'm going to come home and then I'm going to keep programming and I'm just going to keep learning. And I was always a little like baffled when I would see, you know, thought leaders in our community like DHH be like, yo, you need to like calm the fuck down and take breaks and, you know, leave work at work and work 40 hours and not like be working. Like, it's not like a badge of honor to be saying like, yeah, I worked 80 hours like every week for the last 10 weeks. Don't do that.
Yeah.
But I thought this Reddit thread is really interesting because the takeaways were basically like find, you know, the way that you can prevent burnout is to find hobbies outside of programming and outside of like computer science, which I think is really great because I don't know, if you asked me a year ago what my hobbies are, I would be like, it's programming. And then I think more and more I'm trying to like give my brain a break and like, you know, come home and watch TV, you know, that's fine. You could totally just like turn your brain off for 3 hours and watch Netflix. That's totally fine. Like, you deserve it. And on the weekends, you don't always have to program, you know, like go for a hike, do something like ride your bike around the block, drive your car around.
Is this the thread that says, how did you deal with burnout?
No, it's how do you keep from burning out from at your job? And it's just this guy that's like, hey, I'm a full stack developer.
You'll toss the link in.
Yeah.
I found another thread talking about burnout and the first response is, I just quit, which is great. I couldn't agree more that I think it's important that we as developers take time off, step away from code, do something different. I had someone ask me a question a few weeks ago that totally like was like, oh, this dropped a bomb on me. And it was, when was the last time you did something really fun that your 10-year-old self would have loved doing?
Wow.
And it's like, man, as like a guy who just turned 30, it's just like, it was really hard to answer that question. And when I really thought about it, I was like, it was like 2 or 3 years ago that I did something that my 10-year-old self would have enjoyed and had fun with. And like, I've been trying to do more stuff like that. That's just like straight up just fun stuff that doesn't have any reason or purpose. Cause oftentimes, like as a functioning adult and member of society, it's like every single moment of my free time has to be like somehow productive. Like, oh, my hobby is running. And when I run, I listen to business books and I'm like training for a marathon. It's like, dude, just like calm the fuck down and just do something fun for a second. Like sit in a hammock or go swimming with your dog. Like do something that's just fun that has no purpose at all. It's like lately I've been trying to draw a little bit more and dabble in photography again. And it's been so good seeing how when I'm at work, I'm way more productive and creative and enjoying the work more. It's not watering down me at all. Like it's only making it better and kind of concentrating my efforts. And I kind of thought, well, if I have less quantity of time, my quality output will go down, but I'm seeing the opposite. I'm seeing that my time at work is being concentrated, meaning like I'm more effective in the time I'm spending and I have a better quality of life overall. And I think even my clients are sensing it, that I'm doing better work and putting out better output. So I love that. We'll put the thread, whichever one you found that's got some good tips, in the show notes. And in general, like the PSA is just go take a break, go have fun sometimes.
Yeah, get away from a computer.
For sure. My pick this week is Vue.js. I had a lot of fun. I literally committed to a client project that had to be delivered in 2 weeks, knowing I was going to build it in Vue, knowing nothing about Vue.
Dang.
And I was able to fully deliver the code in Vue, and it was a fantastic experience. It was Like, honestly, totally lived up to the hype for me, especially as someone who is really kind of allergic to React and other front-end frameworks I've tried that are just very, they're amazing and powerful. And I have tons of respect for people who are proficient. For me and the work I do, it's just too much. It's a lot more than I need. Like, I'm doing simpler JavaScript interactions. I'm not doing like crazy complex stuff. And it just felt really right to me and the way I think and the way I work. It doesn't mean it's better or worse. It just was like very much a fit within my stack and within the kinds of problems I'm trying to solve. And so I think especially if you're a Rails person and you've been kind of a grumpy old man like me, kind of allergic to JavaScript, and like really give it a shot in the context of Rails. And I'll put through a couple of links that I found really helpful. But Go Rails stuff on Vue.js is really good. He's doing some amazing work on the Vue.js tips on Go Rails, which is really, really cool stuff. So I would encourage you to just like pick something that you need to solve, whether it's like an index view that it's taking like a sort index view or something like that, something that's like classically kind of a hard problem to solve in Rails, and just like refactor it in Vue, give it a shot. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. So that's the PSA that I'll give. The other one I'll give for today.
Wow, really cool. Vue's been out for just, not just as long as React, but it's been out for quite some time now. And I still haven't given it a shot. One day, maybe, we'll see.
It's funny because I feel like it's something that I didn't try for so long because I'm like, well, I need to like take some time and like give it a shot. Like, it's not that, like, once you get into it, you're like, oh, it's just like not really a thing. Like, there's so much less there to like learn and get your head around. That's what was so refreshing. It's just, oh, it's just these one or two conventions. In a way, it almost felt like BEM, like the CES approach, that it's like, there is a framework here, so don't let me misspeak. There is a framework and it is doing a lot of things. But in a way, it just feels like a way to write your JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And as someone who's like, just tell me how to do it, Vue kind of does that for you, which I really liked. So it's like, there's not that much there. It's just, this is just JavaScript. It's just binding it to the Vue in a way that's really clean and nice and gives you a good convention. But anyway,
cool.
Yeah. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We will see you next week, and we're going to be digging into chapter 3, some higher level stuff about refactoring. We're excited to keep moving through this stuff. Thanks so much for listening.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Peace.